Was there a real Adam and Eve? Does embracing science mean you have to abandon traditional Christian beliefs about Adam and Eve? Find out at the Science and Human Origins Conference on Saturday, September 20th from 9 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. at the Ray and Joan Kroc Center in the beautiful resort community of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. For more information, go to www.discovery.org/origins. That's discovery.org/origins.
Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. On today's episode of ID the Future, we have with us Dr. Anne Gager, who is a senior research scientist at the Biologic Institute. She received her PhD in developmental biology from the University of Washington and was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. And we're going to talk about Anne's contribution to the new book, Science and Human Origins, just published by Discovery Institute Press. So Dr. Gager, thank you very much for coming on the show with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Now, I just have to say that personally, I consider, and I say this as a co-author of the book, I consider your contributions to the book, Science and Human Origins, to be the most important chapters. No offense to Doug Axe. His chapters are wonderful as well. But I do think that your contributions to this book are hitting on some of the most important and hottest issues in the questions about human origins that are out there right now. So the first question I want to ask you is, why has the question of the origin of the human species become such a hot topic in recent years in this debate?
Well, for years, the evidence for our common ancestry with primates was based on fossil evidence, and that was about it. But with the sequencing of the human genome, suddenly we had available to us lots and lots of data about variation in the human populations. And there's a discipline in biology called population genetics that likes to look at the distribution of different kinds of mutations in the population and figure out where they came from and what the history of those mutations might be, sort of a retrospective calculation. So with all that data, that's exactly what people have started to do. And they've used this data to try and estimate where we came from, how long ago, and how many of us there were at the time. The reason it's become such a hot topic recently is because some scientists have made claims that say we cannot have come from two first parents. And it's drawn religious believers into the debate on both sides. And of course, it has those implications.
Yes, and in fact, the irony is that in some cases, it was people who would call themselves Christian theistic evolutionists that are making some of the loudest and strongest arguments against there having been two initial first parents. We'll maybe talk about that argument on a scientific level, strictly, of course. But let's first talk about the bigger question of whether humans and apes share a common ancestor. So first of all, obviously, you go to the zoo. I was just at the zoo a few weeks ago, down in Mexico, actually, and I saw some apes that they had there. And they do have some anatomical similarities to us. There's no question. So are humans and apes really all that similar, anatomically speaking? What are some of the anatomical similarities, and what are some of the anatomical differences?
Well, it's a yes and no kind of answer that I'm going to give. We are like chimps in many ways. That's why we're categorized as primates. If you look at the skeletons of chimps and humans, you can see similarities and some differences. The most striking differences are they're built for life in the trees, and we're built for walking and running upright in a way that chimps just can't handle. And that's reflected in our skeleton. We have a larger brain case and a larger brain. We have adaptations that make it possible for us to run that chimps don't have. So it's a yes and no sort of thing. In fact, a recent study published in the journal Nature estimated that there are hundreds of differences in our anatomy and our physiology between chimps and humans. Some of them make us significantly different in our response to diseases and parasites. So for example, you can't use a chimp model for HIV because they don't contract the disease. Yeah. They don't get the same strain of malaria that we get. There are other things like that that distinguish us.
What about behavior? What are some behavioral differences between humans and chimps?
This is a sensitive topic because there are lots of social scientists who try and find commonalities with us in chimps. And they try and pin lots of our own social behavior in the origin with chimps. And I think they take it too far. We live in groups, so do chimps. We have a tendency towards aggressive behavior, so do chimps. And some people would say that chimps have the capacity to reason, to figure things out. But when you actually look at the details, it's on a totally different scale. For example, chimps aren't capable of language in the same way we are. Chimps can learn certain sign language words, but they don't assemble them into sentences, and they don't create complex thought with the words they have. It's mostly a mimicry and a learned behavior that allows them to get what they want from the people they're interacting with. They don't write poetry. They don't compose music. They don't paint self-portraits. Those are the kinds of things that distinguish us behaviorally. They're also, although they do have some cooperative behavior, they don't have anything like the social structure that we have and the same sense of altruism.
So would you say that humans are exceptional?
Definitely. We are exceptional among all life on Earth. As far as we can tell, gray whales or humpbacks may sing, but what they sing is not on the order of a symphony.
Yeah, as I like to say, until chimps are writing scientific papers about humans, rather than the other way around, you better not go around trying to denigrate human exceptionalism, because I think it's tough to make the argument that there is no distinction there between us and them. Yeah.
Even the use of tools. Chimps use tools, but it's on the order of poking a straw into a termite mound to retrieve some termites. It's not even a one or two step process. Crows, for example, can raise the level of liquid in a jar so to float the food higher so they can reach it. But they don't design cars or rockets to the moon or even cell phones. I don't suspect that a cell phone would survive very long in a chimp colony.
Yeah, yeah. Or I like the example of, you'll see seagulls that will pick up mussels and then fly up and drop them onto the dock from up high, and they'll crack them open. And that's an intelligent way of cracking open a mussel, but that's a different level of intelligence.
Animals do have intelligence. They do have the capacity to learn from one another. And they also have instinct. Most of their behavior is either learned from previous generations or instinctual. They don't have the same capacity to share culture that we do.
Well, I want to ask one last question about your first chapter in the book Science and Human Origins, and that is, how does the time scale pose a problem for humans and apes sharing a common ancestor? In other words, if there are these differences between humans and chimpanzees, is it compatible with the fossil record to say that we had enough time to evolve all these differences in the last, say, 5 or 6 million years?
Okay, here's the hidden secret that nobody talks about in population genetics, and that is the equations are pretty rigid in what they will permit. If you have a population of a particular size and a mutation rate of a particular size, the equations give you an estimate for how long it would take to achieve a certain number of adaptations, say, for example. And in the case of the change from chimp-like ancestor to human, we have 5 to 6 million years, but published work in the literature, taking into account our population size and the estimated population size of our chimp-like ancestor, mutation rate, et cetera, they say it takes at least 6 million years to fix one mutation in a DNA binding site in a target of 1,000 bases. Okay, that's 6 million years to achieve one mutation. That's the entire window we have to go from a chimp-like ancestor to a human. So there's an obvious problem. Now, here's the other piece to the argument. They argue that, well, it's because all those mutations, it's not just one target that's being screened, it's 20,000 targets, the 20,000 different genes in the human genome, all independently mutating, all independently being screened. But if you look at the kinds of adaptations it would be necessary to get from a chimp-like animal to us, those adaptations require that they happen coordinately. So, for example, it's no advantage to a chimp to suddenly have human-like hips if their feet and their spine and their necks are adapted for living in trees. they'll just be a miserable chimp. It's no advantage to learn to walk upright if you have no neck and you're forced to look down because you can't get your head upright. And it's no advantage to be able to run if your rib cage is compressed and not able to move freely. And so you have to have all of those traits at the same time. And that's, in fact, what we see in the fossil record. The move from a chimp-like skeleton to a upright bipedal Homo skeleton is sudden, and there aren't any transitions in between.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gager. This is wonderful to speak with you about these issues. The book is Science and Human Origins. It's a new book from Discovery Institute Press, co-authored by Dr. Ann Gager, the first author, Dr. Douglas Axe, and myself, Casey Luskin. You can check it out at discoveryinstitutepress.com. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute.